I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. The award-winning playwright Sarah Rule and the poet Max Ritvo met at Yale University in 2012. She taught playwriting. He was a student. Their encounter in the classroom led to an extraordinary relationship, which they chronicled in a new book called Letters from Max, A Book of Friendship. Sarah Rule joins me to talk about this beautiful and insightful peroration on life and death, poetry and plays, love and remembrance. Plus, Voices Rise, a Baltimore choir of hope, is a chorus from Paul's Place, a community service organization in West Baltimore. They join me in Studio A to help us sing in the season. The bonds of friendship and hope for the holidays. Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. On this day of the winter solstice, when darkness prevails and the pre-holiday scramble is at a fevered pitch, let's take a moment to slow down and reflect on the things that really matter in life. Today on Midday, a conversation about an extraordinary relationship between a teacher and her student, fellow writers and confidants, who became the closest of friends and who shared a journey of discovery as one of them, the gifted student, succumbed to cancer. My guest is the acclaimed playwright, poet, and author Sarah Rule. Her latest book is called Letters from Max, A Book of Friendship. It's a collection of her correspondence with Max Ritvo, who took a playwriting class with Sarah at Yale University. Max Ritvo was a poet who had begun attracting a significant following before he died of cancer at the age of 25. This book is a beautiful compendium of insightful ruminations on the big issues facing humankind, things like life and death, the afterlife, and love. But it's also a cheerful and playful chronology of how two friends formed a beautiful and inspiring bond. Sarah Rule joins us on the line from her home in Brooklyn, New York. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
I have to tell you, this book is just beautiful.
Thank you so much.
The experience of reading this book was just a delight, a compelling and important experience for me. So I'm very grateful to you both. I told folks a little bit about Max. I told the folks that Max is no longer living, but tell us about Max. Introduce us to him.
Well, Max was an extraordinary person, and he combined the gift of conversation, you know, being able to talk about everything under the sun, with an extraordinary capacity for deep listening. And he was also very funny. And, you know, just to give you an example, he had applied to my playwriting class, and it was an advanced playwriting class, but he'd never written a play before. And I accepted him because I learned that he was in an experimental comedy troupe and was also a poet. And I thought, well, what better combination than, you know, a funny poet in terms of becoming a playwright?
And when you think about his work, is there a way of give us a thumbnail sketch of his work? At one point you wrote him, you said that, "I think you're bringing us along where poetry needs to go, away from the small and confessional, into a big world, the world of death, love, and metaphysics." I mean, you mentioned he was very funny, and that certainly comes out in the book as we get to know him in the course of this correspondence. But he did take on the big issues, did he not?
Mm-hmm. He did. I mean, he wrote about God, he wrote about death, he wrote about religion and spirituality, and he wrote about the body. And one thing that amazed me about his poetry that last year, and one thing that's amazing about Max is he wrote so much so quickly. So there's a new collection of his called The Final Voicemails, which is quite beautiful, that his teacher, Louise Glick, edited after Max died, and it just came out. And, you know, his focus on the body as he was dying, the body was still sensual. The body was still a source of joy. He has a couple extraordinary poems in that collection about the idea that he wants there to be no boundary between his body and the air of the world. And he wrote beautiful love poems. He also got married in that 4 years when he was sick. So he writes gorgeous poems to his wife and to his friends. He had really a gift for friendship. He was always collecting friends, new poet friends, new writer friends, and all kinds of friends.
The book that he was in the process of having published during the time period that this correspondence was taking place is called Four Reincarnations, and there's a fascinating back and forth between you two about what he should title the book. I mean, he went through all sorts of different, ruminations about that decision. But reincarnation and the afterlife, these are things that you do talk about at length.
Yeah, and it was interesting because I was writing a play called The Oldest Boy at a point, which is to do with reincarnation, and the idea is that there's a Tibetan man married to an American woman, and their child is identified as a tulku, or a reincarnated high teacher. And at a point in Max's and my friendship, we would trade manuscripts, so I would send him a play, and he would send me a poem, and we would go back and forth, and so he wrote a poem based on The Oldest Boy, which was about reincarnation. If you want me to, I can read it for you.
That'd be great. We'd love to hear it.
So this is called Refuge for Sarah. Rain falls on the house. My mother dries dishes in the dark house in the rain. I'm your little dish, I tell her, even though I ought to be a man. You're a big dish. You mean I'm very wet? I haven't seen much and don't see much. The jungle of my short life is one row of white, straight, naked trees. The vines are white and fall apart in my hands, as if dissolved under the tongue. Every living thing is screaming dust. To imagine a heaven is to admit there are things in this world you think you could never bring yourself to love, even given an unlimited number of attempts. Learn to love everything. The world becomes heaven. I have a better idea. Pass the soap. I tell you now, unhappily knitted to bravery, that all you must do is hate yourself round and round, hand in hand, foaming mouth open, rainbow bubbles dashing open. Hate yourself more than any other thing. You have made heaven. And this poem, for me, is quintessential Max, because it's about heaven, it's about the ordinary, washing dishes with your mother. And then there's a joke, he's talking about the sublime, and then he turns and there's a joke, and I actually read it incorrectly and missed a line. So he goes from the line, learn to love everything, the world becomes heaven, and then he goes straight to, that sounds hard,
that sounds
I have a better
hard.
Idea, pass the soap.
Yeah, that sounds hard, I have a better idea, pass the soap, and then hate yourself more than any other thing, you have made heaven.
Yeah.
That's just that's one of those instances, because there's so much about poetry. I'm not being a poet myself. I mean, a lover of poetry. I love talking to poets about their work. I loved reading the poetry that both you and Max wrote in this book. But there's so much of poetry that I don't think I quote unquote understand. You know, what does it mean to understand, to appreciate, to know what the poet's intent is? Because so many times, it's just not something that seems readily apparent.
Mm. And I think there's a mystery at the heart of that poem. And, I knew Max incredibly well, and I myself couldn't exactly parse for you what it means, hate yourself more than any living thing, you've made heaven. And I've thought about it a lot, and I've thought, was Max talking about the ego, slashing through the ego to create heaven? What exactly did he mean? Or did he mean, even though you might hate yourself more than any living thing, you have made heaven? And I think sometimes the way poetry is taught in schools, we're taught that there's a code and you have to decode it. And if you don't, you're outside the poem and you're not clever. And I think that's the opposite of the ancient roots of poetry and the intention of poetry, which is to invite the reader in. And I think that's another thing I loved about Max's poetry, is there was a directness, a kind of stretching a hand across to the reader that I really appreciated in this poetry. And at one point he had said to me in the book, he said, I went to this reading of poets and I didn't understand what this one woman was saying. And I told her after I was having a hard time getting a sense of, or I asked her what she meant. And she said, you're not supposed to get anything. It's not supposed to mean anything. And Max didn't know what to do with that.
Yeah. None of us would. Yeah. I mean, you've already made me feel much, right. much better about my ignorance.
You know,
yeah.
you need to resist that kind of opacity in yeah. your poetry. And yeah. I think there's some kinds of university poets and avant-garde poets who really took a beat from Ezra Pound when he was starting to shut people out of poetry. And there's a strand of contemporary poetry that went that direction. And I think Max could penetrate the mysterious, which means there's still going to be a little mystery left, but ultimately he was very transparent about his emotions and his poetry.
Sarah Rule, the book is called Letters from Max, A Book of Friendship. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. We'll take your calls and comments a little bit later in the program. So, Sarah, on that, to follow up on that point, at one point, Max writes a letter to you and says, "Feeling alienated, I imagined how different my interior life is from the interior life people imagine me having." Mm. This relationship between the two of you is extraordinary. It's unlike any other relationship I'm familiar with, either in my personal life or knowing other people. And it's one of the great joys of reading the book, because you have a window into this just really extraordinary relationship. But as close as you two were, because you were besties in the full meaning of the term, you know, is it possible for anyone to know anyone else? I mean, here's Max talking about his interior life and how different it is from people, what they think it is.
I do think it's possible to know another person. I mean, never completely. But we have these interchanges, too, in the book about whether the soul exists and what is the soul. And Max said something in the book, and I can't quite find it at this moment in time, but it was about, you know, a person's soul exists because another person's soul regards it. You know, that there's this reciprocity in a relationship, a making of the other when the other is fully seen. And I think, you know, one extraordinary thing about my friendship with Max was that writers can be so focused on the interior. You know, we're such a private bunch in
sure.
so many ways, or can be. So when a writer finds another writer who you can share your interior life with, it's kind of magical.
The other thing that strikes us about reading this book is the difficulty that all of us have when we're speaking to someone who is very ill.
Mm-hmm.
It's just hard to know what to say when someone mm-hmm. is under chemotherapy or radiation, or has been given a sentence or given a diagnosis that says, you know, the disease you have is not curable, and
yeah.
we're going to make you comfortable until you pass away. You learn. It seemed that you learned a lot about that in the process of this friendship.
Yeah. And, you know, it is so hard to know what to say. And I think some people then just kind of recede because it makes them uncomfortable. And my father died of cancer when I was 20. He was diagnosed when I was 18. And I remember it's an awkward moment where a friend of a friend had stopped by, and my dad's cancer was stage 4 when it was diagnosed, and he had brought a new girlfriend along who was a therapist, and I think she wanted to show that she was really open. So she said to my father, "How does it feel knowing that you're going to die?" Like, basically knowing when you're going to die. And my father was so taken aback and affronted. And, you know, the woman thought of it as this entry point to conversation, but my father found it just both yeah. funny and sort of deeply inappropriate.
Yeah. Very funky icebreaker. Yeah.
Funky icebreaker was like the second thing out of her mouth. Like, she'd been thinking about what she was going to say. And I think when I think about that as an object lesson, and when I think about Max, I think the most important thing we can do with someone who's ill is to listen, not to be thinking what is the right thing to say. Just abandon those thoughts and listen, you know, to the person who's going through it, because that person is the expert of what their experience is. You can't possibly divine what they want to hear and say it. There is no perfect Hallmark card for this situation, so you have to listen.
Yeah, boy, A lot more listening and a little less talking these days in the
public
sphere. Oh, my
God. Our culture at large, we're just so lost art of listening, for
indeed.
Sure.
Sarah Rule is a playwright who has been twice nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. She's also a MacArthur Award winner who has been nominated for a Tony Award. She's on the faculty of the Yale School of Drama, where she first encountered Max Ritvo, a poet with whom she has written a beautiful book. It's called Letters from Max, a book of friendship. We'll have more with Sarah Rule when we come back from a quick break. If you'd like to join our conversation, our number here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. You can drop us a tweet @MiddayWIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up Monday on Midday, the Midday Christmas Eve special. We will eschew all talk of politics and policy and the arts, and we're going to have an hour of music and readings of the season instead. So, Secretary Mattis is going to resign from the Defense Department at the end of February. We're not going to talk about that. We're not going to talk about the drawdown of troops in Syria and Afghanistan. Another, not going to talk about it. There's the Mueller probe. We could always talk about the Mueller probe. Let's face it, the Mueller probe, it's like air. It's just around all the time. We are talking about nothing having to do with any of that stuff on Monday. So fair warning, it's a politics-free zone on Monday. Baltimore writer Rafael Alvarez is going to share his Christmas story, Aunt Lola. We're going to hear some poetry by Alfred Lord Tennyson, T.S. Eliot, and a couple of others. Plus, we'll hear some choral music by Rosephanie Dunn Powell and James Lee III, two of America's most highly respected African-American composers. So I hope you'll join us for the Midday Christmas Eve special Monday on Midday. And by the way, coming up a little later today, a little more music, the Voices Rise Choir of Paul's Place in West Baltimore. They're coming back to Studio A to share some carols and holiday music, so stay tuned for that. If you have just joined us, my guest is the poet, playwright, and author Sarah Rule. Her new book is a gem. It's called Letters from Max, a Book of Friendship. If you'd like to join our conversation with Sarah Rule, our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. You can send us a tweet @MiddayWIPR, and you can follow me on Twitter @TomHallWIPR. Sarah, let's go to the phones, if you don't mind. Tim is on the line from Baltimore. Tim, welcome to Midday with Sarah Rule.
Yeah, hi. Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, sir, yeah. You are on the air.
Good, good. Tom, how are you? Your producer will pass along my message to you. And Ms. Rule, I just think it's so wonderful that both of you are talking about the things that truly do matter in this life, in our short term on this globe. I told your producer I have been so inspired by your discussion, your talk, by you, Sarah, and by Max and his book and his poems. I am going to rush out when I get back to my local Barnes & Noble, which is my most convenient bookstore, and buy the book for my poet son who comes in tonight from L.A., and it's something I know he'll appreciate. And I'll steal it from him and read it myself.
Well, thank you for that call, Tim.
So,
Sarah, one of the other interesting dynamics here in this book is this relationship that began teacher-student.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, full disclosure, my daughter, Miranda Rose Hall, is a playwright. She studied at the Yale School of Drama with you and others. And since she graduated a few years ago, she has now continued a relationship with you as her mentor, as her friend, as her confidant, as her supporter. And it's a beautiful and wonderful blessing to her. This evolution between teacher-student to go to friend, there's also this male-female dynamic. There's an older-younger dynamic. There's the professional dynamic. You know, you're the playwright and a poet. He's a poet. You're married to your husband, Tony. He's married to his wife, Victoria. It seems like Facebook would call this really complicated.
And I would call it really simple, you know, in a funny way. I would call it really simple, two people who understand each other. Emerson called a friend someone before whom I can think aloud, and that's how I always felt about Max. And I'm glad you mentioned Miranda, the extraordinary Miranda, because she read a. I mean, you know, you become colleagues when a writer graduates, and I think when you teach creative writing, it's a little different than teaching another kind of subject because it is so intimate, and you're dealing with people birthing, you know, little bits of their soul into the universe. So. You know, of course, there are professional boundaries and teaching boundaries, but you get to know each other quite well anyway. So when writers graduate, I'm fond of, you know, taking them out for a drink and saying, now we're colleagues. Isn't it wonderful? And with colleagues, you share work. And I sent Miranda a draft of letters from Max at one point. I think we swapped, and she sent me a play. And we were having a meal, and I was telling her a story about Max, which was that I said that people will think I'm crazy, but I actually think Max can communicate with me now by sending me little pieces of litter on the sidewalks of New York in the shape of hearts. And that, and I knew Miranda wouldn't think I was crazy. And she said, well, why didn't you write that in the book? I said, because I thought people would think I was crazy. And she said, I think you should put it in the book.
And it's in there.
And it's in there. So she had a real impact. And in fact, that's sort of one of the closing parts of the book, is this reflection on if it's possible that somehow Max is shaping litter through the ether and shaping them like perfectly sculpted tinfoil hearts in my past, and maybe it's not, you know, in a literal sense true, but maybe it's a metaphor, and it reminds me that one lesson Max taught me is that there's beauty even in the ugly. Or even in the apparently ugly, if you look for it, you know, even in litter, you can find love or beauty. And even in a body that's, you know, in incredible pain with cancer, still you can find beauty, which Max did in his poetry.
It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. My guest today is Sarah Rule. She is the author, along with Max Ritvo, of Letters from Max, a book of friendship. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet at @midday_WYPR. The other thing that really fascinated me about this book was what you've just talked about, how writers bounce ideas off of each other. They trade their work, they get mm-hmm. feedback, because that also seems to me to be a really difficult thing to do, to give somebody feedback about their work. And I'm speaking of Miranda, a few years ago, she gave Linnell and me, my wife Linnell, a book of your, a collection of your plays, The Clean House and other plays. And when she inscribed it, she said, begin with Eurydice, that's one of your plays, and mm-hmm. end with the rest, and you will understand why I write plays. And that whole notion of understanding the work of another writer mm-hmm. and using it as an inspiration for your own, you and Max really demanded a lot of each other. You were sending each other poems and plays and stuff, and you were expecting a kind of erudition in the response that was really going to mean something. Boy, that's a lot of pressure, it seems.
Well, Virginia Woolf describes poetry as the voice who answers back in Orlando, and I think of Max as the voice who answered back to me and to so many other writers. And I think one thing to keep in mind with writers or other artists is sometimes they don't really want erudition. The only thing they truly want when you send them your work is for them to say, I read it and I loved it. That's actually all you need to know. And when you go to a playwright's opening night, you don't need to say anything clever. You just need to say, that was wonderful, I loved it. I mean, we're all so vulnerable, we're all so exposed, that truthfully, half of teaching is encouraging the coming out of the work and not stopping it. You know, some teachers actually shut students down by accident, or sometimes purposely, by being too hard on them. The point is to not stop the flow of the work. And Max had such a deluge of creativity, and he was just writing constantly. So part of my role as a teacher was to just encourage him and to say, and I always mentioned, I loved your poem. You know, your poem was sublime. And Max didn't actually need a whole lot more than that.
Yeah. In another one of your books that I really loved, this came out a few years ago, it's a collection of what you call micro essays. It's called 100 Essays I Don't Have Time to Write, on umbrellas and sword fights, parades and dogs, fire alarms, children and theater. So that basically sums up about everything that a writer would need to write about. But you have one of your essays, and when I say micro, some of these are very short. For example, this is a one-word essay. It's titled, "Is There an Objective Standard of Taste?" And the entire copy of the essay is, "No." So, you know, the fact that there isn't an objective standard of taste, I couldn't agree with you more, makes it all the more difficult to respond to somebody's work, original work. I mean, as a musician, I had composers sending me stuff all the time saying, "Do you like this? Do you like this?" And a lot of times I didn't like it. I mean, I wasn't going to program it. I wasn't going to conduct it. And I, oh my gosh, now these are people I love. I just don't love this piece. Did you encounter that with Max? I mean, in this book, you seem to like everything he sent you. And so did I, by the way.
There were letters I didn't include where I gave him more specific feedback that I thought would be tedious, in a book. But there were times when I thought he would get too abstract or opaque, and I would say, "What did you really mean?" Or that was a little bit portentous. And we went back and forth on his. He asked about titles for Reincarnations. I think was originally a different, maybe four oracles, and I said, "That's really hard to say. Like, it's really hard to get your mouth around four oracles." So there was some pointed feedback. But I think when I teach too, I think, you know, in some ways I think of it as playing the love game. You know, what could you find to love about something, even if as an entire work it repelled you? And, you know, luckily I never had to do that with Max's poetry because I intuitively loved it. But there are times when you read something by a student and it repulses you, and you have to play the love game and think, what one sentence did I love or what impulse to create this did I love?
Always look on the bright side of life. There you go. Because at one point he answers one of your letters. And he says, "It's taken me just over a year to attempt to reply to your letter." I mean, the thoughtfulness, he struggled with it, clearly, you know, and then he finally, and he wrote this long peroration, responding to what you had talked about. And he says, "I have a natural tendency to cut people off mid-sentence, to barely hear what they say before trying to touch it with my own mouth. I think my silence over this letter tells you how deep it goes." Boy, that guy could write.
Yeah, that was an astonishing letter. And what it came from was we had pizza on the Upper East Side at one point when he'd gotten bad news about his treatment not working. And he told me he was afraid of death. And I kind of went home and wrote him this long letter that I hoped would comfort him, that was my views of the afterlife and about some dreams I had about death that comforted me. And he took a year to reply to it. And, of course, we were in touch, and he thanked me for the letter. But, you know, we were in touch about a million other things. But he waited a year to really address it when he was ready to write it. And I think part of it was that he didn't really want to confront his mortality at the time that I wrote him the letter. He wasn't ready yet. And a year later, he was.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, so many things about that move me. But one is how our culture, our instant culture, we have to respond almost as soon as the words leave the air. We must respond. And Max was so wise, and he knew to wait.
At some point in the middle of this process, you did decide, the two of you, to think about collecting these letters as a book.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another beautiful part of this. This isn't one of these things where my friend Max died at age 25, and so now I'm going to bring out all of our letters, you know, just on your own. You did this in concert with him. But did it once you made that decision, once you decided, you know, this might be for a book, did it change the way you corresponded? Did it change how you wrote to each other?
I mean, I think for one, the most obvious answer is our letters got longer.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe they got a little bit more intentional. Were topics we talked about more intentionally, but I don't think it changed the tone of them or the tenor of them. And I think that, you know, originally I thought, oh, maybe we'll just make a little handmade book for friends and family with some of our favorite letters in them. That was the kind of project I conceived of. And then suddenly we had sort of like 400 pages of letters, and Max was becoming a really well-known poet. And it seemed like, no, this is actually a book. It has the weight of a book, not a little handmade manuscript that we circulate. So it was really lucky that we got to collaborate on the project before he died and talk about it at length and go back and forth. And then ultimately I finished the book on my own and curate it and structure it. But Max and I collaborated on it deeply while he was alive.
We learn a lot about Max, and we learn a lot about you in this book. Talk about your journey from being a poet. That's where you sort of started when you were an undergraduate, and then you evolved into a playwright, but you're still writing poems. And as a matter of fact, Max Ritvo is one of the reasons that you got your first poem published.
It's true. Yeah, I started as a poet. That was what I wanted to do. And it was, in fact, a teacher, the great Paula Vogel, who convinced me to write plays instead. And I always scribbled a little poetry on the side, and sometimes I would snatch a couplet here and there and put it in a play. But I was very secretive about my poetry and private about it. And Max really encouraged me to send him my poetry, and he's very persuasive. All of his friends and family would tell you that Max was very persuasive. So if Max had sent me a poem or show me an old poem, I would. And then at one point Max said, with your permission, I'd like to give some of your poems to my friend Elizabeth Metzger, who's a wonderful poet, and she published one of them. So it's somehow bizarre and fitting that my first grown-up poem was published because of Max, who was my student.
Well, you say at one point that you think there's a kind of equation for playwrights that indifferent to bad poets make good playwrights. I will respectfully disagree. I wonder, would you read us one of your poems? There's one that I just love so much. It's on page 137. Yeah. It's called An Automated Recording from a Hospital Near You, and you wrote this for Max.
Yeah, okay. An x-ray of your soul shows a general radiance, while the scan of your breath shows only poetry, waiting on the biopsy of your imagination, but we suspect it cannot be contained. Your body cannot contain you. You're way too wide for that. And if there is a Jewish heaven, it is here on earth, on 13th Street, you shouting poetry in a crowded room, circling and wearing a pink kimono. And this poem I wrote shortly after seeing Max perform at 13th Street Rep. He had just won a poetry prize and got a chapbook published, and went shout to the rafters. You know, he had this booming voice. He loved to perform, and he would often wear something fabulous and sometimes outlandish, and often it was a kimono. So on this occasion, he had a pink kimono, and the house was packed. There were so many people that some people were sitting on the stage to hear Max read, and he always wanted to include people. And so he actually spun. You know, he was slowly rotating, reading his poetry to include everybody in the room, which is such an image of Max. You know, this acute presence, this awareness of everyone listening, even the people behind him.
And you confess in the book to being really reticent about performing poetry readings, but he dragged you along and got you to do it.
Yes, he asked me to perform or read one time with him at 13th Street Rep, and I did, reluctantly. And I think Max was probably instrumental in me getting over a kind of fear of public speaking. I tend to not like it, particularly with poetry, because there's something so vulnerable about reading your own poem. I find it less vulnerable to read play out loud or an essay or a speech, but reading your own poetry, really, when I was in my early 20s and did that, I would just be trembling. I just want to disappear into the earth. I felt like I was, you know, opening myself in this incredibly vulnerable way.
Sure, we got
to... Max modeled for me, teacher, how you could share it in a generous way, in a forthright, generous way with people.
We're running out of time, so the last thing I want to mention to folks is that you wrote a play called Dear Elizabeth, which is an adaptation of letters between Robert Lowell and Elizabeth Bishop. So this epistolary form is something that you had some experience with. Were there big challenges? I mean, as you think about your relationship with Max, and as you sifted through all of these many, many letters and emails, what was the sort of overriding philosophy about what you wanted to include and how you wanted to structure it?
Well, I think the deep challenge for me was that when Max was alive, he didn't want it to be structured chronologically, and he wanted it to be structured through subject matter. And he and I tried various structures where we did that, and the publisher kept rejecting them. And I reflected after he died that part of why he might have resisted chronology was that, for one thing, it put it sort of in a cancer narrative, and he didn't want to be known as a person having cancer. He wanted to be known as a poet, primarily. And I think the other thing that must have been hard for him was knowing that he wouldn't be there at the end of the book. But I felt like when I looked at the letters in their totality, chronology just made the most intuitive sense to me.
Well, the book makes a whole lot of sense to the reader as well. So, Sarah Rule, it's really been great talking to you about this. I'm sad for your loss. I am happy for your book. And I wish you and your family happy holidays. Thanks so much.
Such a pleasure to meet and talk with you. Thank you so much for having me.
Sarah Rule, the book she has lovingly and poignantly crafted with her friend Max Ritvo is called Letters from Max, A Book of Friendship. Coming up, some holiday music from a wonderful choir. They are based out of Paul's Place, a service organization that helps folks who are sometimes experiencing homelessness and food insecurity. The choir is called Voices Rise, and they're going to sing for us when we come back from a quick break. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Stay with us.